Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 298 of the Fun with Cars, Formula One, and Other Motorsports podcast, or episode 32 of 2021. I'm Robin Warner, and today I'm joined by the man who is too legit to quit, Jonathan Gitlin. Hey, John.
Well, hey. Hello.
Brought back an oldie, huh? That was my youth right there. I don't know if there was an English version of MC Hammer.
No, we had MC Hammer. He was too legit to quit. He tweets a lot about science these days.
Oh, does he? I do not follow him on Twitter.
Neither do I, but I see it occasionally. He's into science and philosophy in quite a big way, apparently. So that's good, you know.
Well, hey, there are worse things to be into. Anyway.
There certainly are.
It is Monday morning, August 23rd, and John and I are going to talk about the 24 hours of Le Mans, as well as the IndyCar race at Gateway, and I have three interviews to include, which it is headlined by Toyota ambassador Alexander Wirtz, and then I also spoke with Porsche GTE Pro driver Cooper McNeil of WeatherTech fame, we could say, and also... we talk about all kinds of things with SRO Pro Driver and my good friend, Rob Holland. So he's my good friend. I don't know if he would consider me his good friend, but it might be one-sided there.
He wrote an interesting thing the other day. He got to drive the new 911 GT3 back-to-back with the GT3 Cup car.
Yes.
Which on Road Atlanta, which seemed like a lot of fun. It was a good piece.
Yeah, Porsche invited me to that, and I turned him down. I said, I don't have time for this nonsense. So they went with their backup guy.
That was smart of you. That was clever.
No, you know, Rob does a lot of really interesting things. He's got a varied career and many talents, and he uses them to great effect, in my opinion. So anyway, there was an hour that just kept going and going and going through the night, the 24 hours of Le Mans. No one would have ever guessed that Toyota pulled off its fourth win in a row. But there it was, a Toyota 1-2 for the 24 Hours of Le Mans. Yes, I just gave away the ending already. Jonathan, what did you think of the race?
I'll be brutally honest with you. I still love endurance racing more than anything else, but Le Mans kind of been pretty boring since 2018. Which, yes, is the start of Toyota's four wins, but what competition have they really had? I mean, this was not a classic Le Mans. I don't think this is going to be one that people are going to watch, you know, recaps of 10 years from now.
There were some interesting bits to it, but let me first say a couple things. When Audi first started its reign of dominance at Le Mans, it didn't have tons of competition when it started.
Yeah, it did. Yeah.
2001?
So Audi's first win was 2000.
Was it 2000? I thought it was 2001. Either way.
Wasn't their first win 2000?
Because they had the R8R, I think they called it, or the R8C. And that was a podium car. That didn't win. And then
that was 99, I thought.
I thought that was 2000. Check. Ah, see, now we're going to have to ask the all-knowing Google.
We are. So the R8C was, oh, you're right. No. Yeah, 1999. They raced and they replaced. Right. The new R8 came in 2000. So, and you know, the R8C sort of evolved into the Bentley.
Yeah, okay.
Raced
yep.
a few years
yeah,
later.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Which a lot of people always say, oh, that Bentley was just an Audi with a roof. But it wasn't. The only thing they shared was an engine. And conceptually, the Bentley was very similar. Well, it was an evolution of the R8C because they were both designed by Peter Ellery. But, yeah, there was no... The R8 that went on to win everything until finally. In fact, actually, even when the organizers kept adding more ballast and bigger restrictors to the R8 in 2006, it was still winning races. And then they introduced the R10, the big old diesel R10. That thing was. Did you ever see that race? Have I asked you this before?
Which one?
The R10, the diesel.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen it race. Yeah.
And just the way it goes past and it's just silent. That was
it's insane how quiet crazy. Those diesels were. Absolutely.
Anyway, I'm sorry. We've gone to a sidetrack. What was the...
Well, my point is that Toyota didn't have much competition here. I agree, no. But I think that Audi's competition was over, has been overblown. That was the original point of this. I mean, what competition did they have?
Well, they so there were customer cars, and you know there was the you know there might be four. I can think of years where there were, you know, four Audis in the field, but they were all being run by different teams. So there was, you know, there was a battle there. I don't know. I'm waiting for 2023. You know, LMDH is coming next year. We'll have Peugeot in LMH, but it's going to be their first year. So, you know, we shouldn't expect them to have a better race than Glickenhaus. Glickenhaus, I have to say, I've got to give them respect. They got two cars to the end of the race. You know, they might
four
not
laps
be exactly
behind and seven laps behind. Yeah. Their lead, Glickenhaus, was the same four laps behind as the Alpine Elf. I mean, It was a respectable result considering everything.
It certainly was. Yeah. I'd like it if they got into fewer fights with people on the internet.
You mentioned that last podcast, yes.
Did I? Okay. But I have to say, I'm impressed with what they did. They got to the end. Now they have to make their car fast, but it's probably easier to make a reliable car quick.
Here are some interesting facts about this Le Mans. This was the first year of the quote-unquote hypercar, which is the new thing from the last generation, which is a little weird. And all five hypercars finished the race, and yet the only hybrids in the field were the Toyota Gazoo Racing hypercars. Yeah. And obviously,
the rules don't say you have to be a hybrid.
Exactly right. And so the question is, did getting hybrid give an unfair advantage the way the rules were set up? Do you think that was just kind of baked in? Because obviously, WEC wanted hybrids. That was the whole point. There have been hybrids for years.
Right. Well, I think they wanted hybrids because they want OEMs. And I think the result was a foregone conclusion because Toyota is the world's largest car company. And Scuderia, Cameron Glickenhaus, with all due respect to them, is not. You know, even if Toyota with the previous program, the TS0 30, 40, 50 cars, I believe they were spending about 80 million euros a year on that, which was much less than Audi or Porsche. But that's still, and even if they're spending half of that now on the new LMH car, which I, you know, have, maybe there's some off-the-shelf stuff they can use. That's still got to be a lot more than Glickenhaus is spending. So, you know, it's racing. If your budget's four times bigger than someone else's, you know, you're probably going to win the race.
Yeah. That's a fair point. Now, so the top class, that was probably the least surprising part for anybody. Toyota did go on to win and win comfortably. However, it was for the first time the number seven Toyota. The last three times it had been the number eight.
I was really happy about that.
Yeah, yeah. So Kamui Kobayashi finally got a win. Mike Conway finally got a win.
Mike Conway finally got a win. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. And Jose Lopez. I don't know how long Lopez has been with the Toyota team, I have to be honest.
He started, I think it was like 3 years ago.
Okay. So he's been, but he's
he
been
had,
waiting a little
but he
while
had a rough
too.
Season. His first year, he crashed the car in testing and he was out for a while. Anyway, it was good. I'm glad the 7 car won. They've been looking for a win for a while.
And they did have some issues. For some reason, they couldn't pick up fuel in the fuel tank all the way to the bottom. So they had to do more pit stops than you would assume a hybrid car would have to do.
What do you think their margin of victory would have been if that hadn't happened then?
Right. Yeah, sure.
So perhaps it was probably good that they had trouble. I mean, at the very beginning of the race, the number 38 LMP2 car was kind of troubling. It was sticking with the hypercars. And for a second, I thought, oh, maybe this is going to be interesting, like 2017, and there's a chance that, you know, an LMP2 car might win overall. But very quickly, I think they ran into trouble, and that didn't happen.
Yeah.
That would have been funny.
But, you know, so it was the five hypercars, all five finished, and all five finished 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So, you know, really kind of a surprising result in how straightforward that was. Do you know what I mean? Like, you expected something to happen, and the fact that nothing major did was in of itself kind of the shocker.
Right. Yeah. Yes, I agree with that.
And what about LMP2? I never paid close attention to them, to be totally honest.
LMP2 has become probably it's the most competitive category, I think.
Yes, I agree with that.
There was some really good racing, although I mean, it's kind of sad, I think, that pretty much everyone uses an Orica. You know, you've got four different manufacturers to choose from. And I guess it turned out that Orica chassis for Le Mans is just way better than anyone else's. So no one races any of the others, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and that's been true in IMSA as well. You know, the Acura. What's that?
Oh, well, the Acura's on the Orica. But, the Dallara's did really well in IMSA for a while.
Yeah. But, in terms of, like, the DPI cars, they generally tended to be Orica's. The Mazda, that was obviously not. That's the name's escaping me right now.
That's Multimatic, which is the same. They're
Multimatic,
they're going to be doing Audi. Yeah, they'll be doing Audi and Porsche. And maybe one other OEM.
Wow. Yeah. So there you go. There's that. And then, but generally speaking, it seemed like the Orica was the chassis of choice for IMSA as well. But and Team WRT went on to win, and good for them.
They had a bit of a heartbreaker at the end.
Yeah. Explain that.
So they were set for a 1-2 finish, and it was halfway around the last lap. The number 41 car, which was driven by Louis Delatraz, Robert Kubica, and Yifei Ye was in the car at the time. It was a Chinese driver. And yeah, it was a throttle sensor that broke halfway around the last lap.
Yeah.
Which, as Kaz Nakajima can tell you from 2016, if you don't finish the last lap, you get nothing here.
Yeah.
Even if you've done more laps than, you know, and when the, so the 41 broke, and then the 31, which was the sister car, with Robert Frins in it, all of a sudden he was racing for the lead, but the car that was in third, which therefore was now in second, was only a couple of seconds behind. And then actually, yeah, it got a little bit crazy. In fact, this was probably the craziest thing I saw all in the whole 24 hours was the, at Le Mans, I suppose there's a tradition of the man waving the checkered flag actually on the start finish line on the track with the cars going round.
Right. Yeah.
Which is fine if everyone's coming round for a photo finish slowly, like Toyota were doing, because, you know, there was a lap between the two cars and, you know, they were taking it easy to the end. But in MP2, there was a race going on. And, you know, they raced to the line and the winning car missed the flagman by maybe a foot.
Yeah. Wow.
That made me suck my breath in.
Yeah. So the racing was good in LMP2, but, you know, the consequences, because there's no manufacturer involvement, I don't know, it just doesn't carry the same weight, which, you know, makes me want to move on to GTE Pro. We did have good manufacturer involvement, and this time it was Ferrari on top with Chevrolet, Corvette finishing second, and Porsche in third. Not the mega list of manufacturers that we'd seen in recent history, but still, you know, good result.
I'm actually going to disagree with you here.
Ooh.
GTE Pro is dying, and this was proof of it. You know, BMW didn't send any cars. The two Porsches were, I kind of felt almost like a half-hearted effort from Porsche. Well, I'm saying that, I mean, they did put in a great pole lap, but, you know, lots of Ferraris, which makes sense. Corvette finally got to run the C8 here, but... Yes. You know, the days of GTE Pro, there's not really any new cars on the horizon, and
I think that's the worrying thing right there is what other than the C8R, what was there that was really new and interesting?
When was the last time you could buy a Ferrari 488? They don't even sell. They don't. It's not a road car they make anymore.
Yeah, because it's been the Tributo for a couple, what, 2 or 3 years now?
Mm-hmm.
The F8 yeah. Tributo. Yeah. So
I mean, I suppose they're mostly the same car, but it. The momentum seems to have gone to GT3 racing. If you'd like the kind of racing where they publish a rule book and say, here, you can use a road car, but, you know, these are the modifications you're allowed to make, and they're pretty kind of limited, and here's the modifications you can make, and they're not limited, you know, but we check the rules, as opposed to, you know, bring us your race car and we'll add some ballast and some restrictors till it goes around our track at about the same speed as all the others. It's kind of sad.
Yeah, is it though? I mean,
but the former way is also kind of expensive.
Yeah, and when you're adding ballast and these types of things, I don't know, that's an odd way to get parity as well, don't you think?
Well, so BOP seems to work in GT3 racing, but I guess the question is, do you want to see a 24-hour race where the GT grid are, you know, the cars are all capable of going around at pretty much the same speed, and it's up to the skill of, like, the amateur, the team of amateur or pro-ams that are running them? Or do you want to see a GT race where, you know, they're road cars but sort of turned up to 11, and they're all pro teams and they're, you know, going out at hell for leather for 24 hours? Not that the Amers aren't doing that, but anyway. And I think a lot of us have grown up with seeing, you know, that pro GT class. And it seems a bit worrying that there might not be one in 2024.
Yeah.
2023,
yeah.
Apparently, they're talking about just doing GTE AM. And then in 2024, they might just do GT3. And that would also be an AM category, which I know Corvette apparently is not pleased about, because they think it's important to race that car at Le Mans against other production sports cars. But there might not be a category to do it.
Well, I mean, we can wax intellectual on this for a moment, because in Le Mans in the 60s, a Corvette C8R type of race car would be the top mm-hmm. class. That would be the thing that's going faster than anything else. You know, we have the Ford GT40 mm-hmm. because of Le Mans racing, and. Mm-hmm. You know, that wasn't a class win. So, nope. You know, it begs the question of where do you want the racing to go full stop? Because production based cars give us more of this like direct race on Sunday, buy on Monday kind of vibe. Mm-hmm. But we've gotten to a point with prototype cars and the speed capability that are, you know, encroaching close to Formula One, it's like, well, do you want to give that up and have more production-based cars as a top class, or do you want to... Do you see what I'm getting at?
I do, but I think that's partly why they slowed... I think that's partly why the ACO slowed the cars down. You know, this year, the hypercars were not racing as far... They were... What was the lap times were like... The pole was a 3:23, I think, and mostly they were racing a few seconds slower than that, obviously, because you're not going qualifying. So, I mean, I think that's, you know... They have slowed those down. And at the same time, you know, a GT3 car now on, you know, modern slicks, those cars are almost as fast as the old Group C cars.
Yeah, I mean, what was their lap time? It was like 3:48, 3:49, something like that for the GTE Pros?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so, yeah, no, it's the cars are incredibly capable. You know, well, if you can go back, a modern GT3 car is roughly... has the same weight to power ratio. And yes, I said weight to power, John.
You love weight to power because you're an engineer and that's the real statistic, isn't it?
roughly the same as a Formula One car in the early 60s. So mm-hmm. that's where we are with the cars today. But anyway, that was like just the general breakdown of what happened before leading up to. So the Friday before the race started, I had a chance to sit down with Alexander Wurz over Zoom, and we had a really nice conversation about his career at Toyota and Toyota's approach to Le Mans, and let's listen to that right now.
Alex Wurz, it's an absolute pleasure to speak with you for a few minutes ahead of the 89th running of the 24 Hours of Le Mans. First off, am I pronouncing your name correctly or even close?
Yes, you do, but to be honest... In my own language, you say it very different. So I'm used to the international commentary and that you said it absolutely perfect.
Ah, wunderbar. Thank you. Appreciate it. So what exactly is your role with Toyota right now? You drove for the team for several years, but now is driver coach the correct way to say it, or is it more than that?
Yeah, well, it's the description would be I'm an ambassador for Toyota, but also sporting advisor. That's a role which is really crossing over several disciplines. But it all started because I joined Toyota when they came back to Le Mans as the lead development driver, as the lead race driver. Been racing for them for a few seasons. And then when I thought, okay, it's really time to let the next generation take the wheel and race, the team said, yeah, but you can stop racing, but you can't leave the team. So you have to remain with us and follow up with the development, with the structuring of how the human performance falls into place. Because more than any other motorsport in Le Mans, you need to really work as a team. And that goes from the drivers to the engineers, tires, engine, the drivetrain, very complex. So you need to see the big picture and you need to work with the individuals. And that is something I have always injected into motorsport everyday life. And I continue to do that. So to be the connection between engineering and the drivers is basically what I'm looking after.
I see. Now, does that put you in a position, this is a 24-hour race, are you in the position to be awake for the full 24 hours to always be that connection, to always be that link in the chain? Or do you yourself get breaks?
Small breaks in between, but it really depends on how the race is unfolding. We had races which was very intense, team internal battles, where it's really down to the wire. Because both cars, if they're running in parallel speed, of course, there's also friction because every team, every engineer wants to win. And just to make sure that we are letting the team fight, but we are doing it in a certain framework. So we are not really putting the elbows out too far, especially no knives out. But that works very well. We have a really good team spirit. And that's something I'm very proud of, that we, it's simple things, is, you know, with the drivers, we always have breakfast together. We always have lunch together. We always have dinner together. We come and go to the circuit together. We go to say hello to the engineers together. So we are aiming to be a group so that when there is friction coming up, it's instantly addressed and we are coaching each other. And that works very well. And also this atmosphere and this thinking of together distributes into the team. It is really a team effort here with us at Toyota Gazoo Racing.
And how have you seen that effort develop? Because Toyota Gazoo Racing is on a string of success, 2018, 2019, 2020, and that immediately succeeded the long run of close calls. My gosh, I mean, I don't remember if it was 2016 or 2017 where it was literally the last lap that you had a failure from a comfortable lead. And so now that you guys are in this string of success, is there more of a playbook that you guys follow? It's like, okay, we know what works and we just follow it. Does that make your job any easier, or do new challenges come every year that you have to address?
Yeah, just a small story on that 16 race where the car broke down the last lap. I was the Grand Marshal of the race event, and there was also our special guest was Brad Pitt. And I was with him when this happened, and I couldn't believe what is happening. And we both said that this is even too much for a Hollywood movie. It would be too kitsch. It was so funny, but actually I started crying because all the effort we put in and the performance we have put, we raised the performance level this year and outpaced Porsche, you know, one of the record winners of this event by 1.5 seconds average a lap. So it was sensationally fast.
You guys were clearly faster. Yes.
Yes. Yes. But do you know what the race teaches you? That Le Mans lets you win. You can't force a victory. You have to be really in tune with Lady Luck here in Le Mans and go with the flow. And the flow was against us. But I think it took us a bit of time to understand of the race spirit and how to go about it. And it became from double check to triple and quadruple check, very systematic, process driven. But even then, you really need to, it's something special of Le Mans. I can't describe it. I've been here many times myself as a driver. Either I won it or I retired with technical issues, mainly in the lead. And it's a brutal race. But that's why we love it, because it's such an amazing challenge, and it brings the best out of you from the engineering point of view, but especially also from the human point of view.
Yeah, I've been to the race a couple of times myself, just as a spectator, and even as a spectator, the aura, just the atmosphere, is unbelievable and absolutely magnetic. Now, You've been with the team several years. You were a driver for the team. You drove the TSW30 and the TSW40. What is the progression like to go from the 30 to the 50 and from those close calls to these wins?
Yeah, so the 30 was a new concept for Le Mans as well, because Le Mans as such had the Group C cars, super fast race cars, beautiful to watch. I loved them so much as a child, which actually made my dream for Le Mans. We then had the era of diesel technology, which with Peugeot or Porsche, I won in a diesel-powered car. It was basically amazing, a diesel engine from a normal machinery, which is basically industrial use, to a sporting car and a sporting automobile, which was a progression over 10 years with amazing technology. But of course, now...
Such an odd sound to hear a race car make. Diesel quietly hum along.
Absolutely, but to drive it was beautiful at the time. But anyway, now no one wants to speak about diesel due to the political issues surrounding this technology. But for me, it was crystal clear when the rules opened to the next type of racing, which was hybrid racing. I have actually resigned from Peugeot at the time when we were winning races, you know, and constantly winning races. I thought I need to be with Toyota. So I called up Toyota Motorsport and says, are you interested in my services? And it was a 2-minute phone call, and we've been clear on the terms, conditions, and that we want to do it because of hybrid technology coming in. And the S030 was just a new... like a UFO landing in the motorsport world, because you leave the garage silent on battery power. We have the four-wheel drive, accelerating out with 1,000 horsepower of hairpins was just extraordinary feeling, and was really setting a new level in car technology, which maybe for the next 10 years we will not reach this level of technology because regulation has tuned the cars a little bit back. Rightly so, for cost controls.
Yeah.
Came the 040, which was just an evolution. So was the 050. I tested many times with it as well. I didn't race it, but it was a really grown-up version of the 30. We polished all the edges, and it became the fastest car in Le Mans, fastest ever lap with Kamui in qualifying, distance record. So it was super, super period to be with. But equally, we have to see that the market is changing, and we've gone into the next level of race cars, which is the hypercars, which becomes a little bit more closer to the road cars, those type of cars you will see on the road. So it's a bit more connecting to the everyday, not the everyday life of everyone, but of the super rich. But the hypercars is a very interesting rule set, and a lot of manufacturers are joining in. So this is super exciting times ahead.
Yeah, and that's absolutely correct, and I'm excited to see it. I've paid pretty close attention to Glickenhaus and what they're attempting. I'm quite curious to see that. And it's also interesting that you talked about the hybrid era. You guys are now the only hybrid in the field. So it's weird how this new technology came and in a way kind of left us again. I know it's returning soon, but... what's it like to now be the only hybrid hypercar out there? Do you feel that that's an advantage, a disadvantage? How do you look at that?
So first of all, we are in a transition period coming from the real LMP1 monster machines into the hybrid, into the hypercar. And we know that there's a lot of manufacturers coming. I mean, there's Ferrari, there's Porsche, there's Audi, there's Peugeot. We will remain. We have fantastic teams like Glickenhaus who are joining the party, which we are extremely happy with. So I feel we're going not into the golden, we're going to go into the platinum era of sports car racing and Le Mans racing. So this is super cool. But now in the here and now, you're right, we're the only hybrid-driven car on the grid. But we have a very good balance of performance, which makes the technologies equal. And you can see on the lap time that a new arrival like Glickenhaus is instantly very close to a long-standing manufacturer in Le Mans, which I really like. This is good, because close together means we have more competitive racing. There's a bit more emphasis also on the driver, because it is now down to the driver, the traffic management, to win or lose the Le Mans race, apart from the reliability. And that makes it beautiful. We have Alpine, which is a French manufacturer, of course, Renault. They're using an older, very proven car. So it's a good mix for this year. But it is, of course, I have to be honest, a transitional year into all the manufacturers arriving for the race.
You raced in Formula One and had a long career in Formula One, both as a race car driver and a test driver. And you raced in Formula One while Toyota raced in Formula One. And then you switched, you won Le Mans with Peugeot in 2009, and then Toyota transitioned to World Endurance Championship and Le Mans. How have you perceived Toyota throughout now decades of racing against them and eventually now with them?
Yeah. So in Formula One, I observed Toyota, of course. I've been in contract negotiation with the team themselves. Didn't really work out because I joined Williams, which then ironically I raced with a Toyota engine in Williams when I was on the other side negotiating with Toyota. These are the things which is typical Formula One stuff. But I have seen a transition of then coming in to a high level performance driven world like Formula One. Initially, just watching them grow up in a sense that they very Japanese in a way, but which I really appreciate, to go in and systematically work on it. But the initial step wasn't easy for them because they had to create everything from new in Germany, which and the audience knows that motorsport in Europe, Formula One is very England driven. You have all the engineering schools, they come all from Great Britain. But so they set up in Germany and it took them a while until they could walk and run. But by the end, their cars, the engines in the V10 era was sensational. They lifted actually the game a lot. And I knew that their process-driven approach in the wind tunnel and their new management under the leadership of Pascal Vazelon was perfect setup for a Le Mans attack. So this is why I then was very pleased to cooperate with Peugeot after my Peugeot times with Toyota and signing up with them. Still being here, of course.
So final question for you. Thank you again for your time. I've been lucky enough to go to Germany several times. I've only been to Austria once. It was beautiful. We went to vineyards and saw some of the countryside. I want to call it Bavarian countryside, but I know obviously it's specifically Austria. So tell me, what makes Austria better than Germany? This, please, promote your country.
It's the Austrians. I mean, Germany is a beautiful country, but we Austrians, we are smaller, we are more friendly, open, we are a mix of Germans and with a bit more lifestyle to it than our loving neighbors in the north. But we are very similar, of course, because we are Germanic, we love that everything is in order. But, you know, in Austria, we are the nation which invented skiing. We live from tourism, so we are very open. To be honest, Austria is maybe one of the best countries in the world in sense of air quality, quality of life, safety and security. We have not much, a very low crime rate. So I'm very happy and proud to be Austrian. We're a small nation, but especially in motor racing, we have a tradition of supplying top-end quality. In terms of many world champion drivers, Le Mans winners, successful Formula One team bosses, etc. So don't underestimate, we are small, but we are here and there. Of course, we can't compare us to your big nation, to the United States of America. But in motor racing, I think we probably have a few more world championship titles in Formula One than you guys.
Oh, that's true. But we definitely have more NASCAR Cup titles than you.
Yes, absolutely. And you make more profits as well.
When it comes to turning left, we can turn left really well. So I'm very much excited to see both your teams do well. You know, all of your drivers, I want to name them all, but I feel like I will flub it. But I really appreciate your time. Great to chat with you. Best of luck tomorrow. I'll be watching closely.
No, thank you very much. And to your audience, it's like, please cross the fingers, not just for Toyota Cars Racing, but for everyone participating in Le Mans. It is a sensational race, but the race is only so cool because of everyone who joins an interest in this crazy idea, which started a long time ago, to race 24 hours, man and machine against the clock. And it is just a very authentic race. So if you can't join live, then it's good to join with you and your audience.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And also stay safe with the pandemic. That, you know, it's so sad that the parade couldn't happen and these things. It's such a special time to parade through Le Mans and those things. But I very much appreciate that people like you, Alex, still put your mask on and compete and give us a race to watch. So yep. Very appreciative of that. So thank you so much. And thank you to Toyota. Good luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Did you know Alexander Wurz paints his own helmets?
Ooh, how about that? I did not know that.
There you go. Most drivers send them off to someone else. Wurz does his own, designs them, paints them.
Did you know that he doesn't race anymore?
I did know that.
So I don't know why you keep painting these helmets. That seems
he paints his kids now because his kids are coming up through karting, I think.
Yeah,
or at least one of his sons.
Yeah, no, Wurz is getting on in years, you could say. But I have to say, it was great to chat with him. Even got a nice little Austrian promotion that I asked him for. So it was a good conversation. And yeah, you know, again, it wasn't a surprise that Toyota finished the way they did, but it's hard work to get there. And
just finishing a 24-hour race is hard.
Exactly. And the way Toyota approaches it, they take it very seriously. And, you know, there you go. So anyway, you and I, we were talking about the LME GT Pros, and that does seem to be a class that's hurting, but there was still a healthy amount of Porsche involvement. And that included Cooper McNeil and WeatherTech Racing driving the number 79 Porsche at Le Mans. And I had a chance to speak with him too. And let's listen to that.
Cooper McNeil, it's an absolute pleasure to speak with you. You are in Le Mans, France, getting ready to compete in the 89th running of the 24-hour race in a GTE Pro Porsche RSR. How does that feel?
That feels great. This will be my eighth time attempting the 24-hour race. So a lot of experience in the past, which is important here at Le Mans, because you don't have much running time, especially with these compressed schedules now because of, COVID and stuff like that. So having prior experience is quite important. And, especially when you're sharing the car with two other drivers, you don't get that much drive time. It's been a busy week. Preparing for the race starts tomorrow afternoon here.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Now, you do have a lot of experience at Le Mans and tons of experience in sports cars and endurance racing, but a lot of that experience has been in Ferraris, you know, Ferrari Challenge and then GT3. I know you've raced Porsches in long ago past, but how has the adjustment been going from Ferrari race cars to Porsche race cars?
Honestly, not a big deal. Both cars are built to a certain standard to compete in the GTE class. So to go from one chassis to the other just requires a little bit of technical things, learning the difference in steering wheel buttons and adjustments and things on the dash, and learning where the certain rotary knobs and switches and stuff like that are located on the Ferrari dash versus the Porsche dash. So
like searching for the Manettino on your 911, probably.
Exactly. So yeah. Driving the two require a bit of a different driving style, but again, they're both built to the GTE standards. The Ferrari is a true mid-engine car. The Porsche was adapted to be a mid-engine car. So they drive similarly, but have their own nuances. So once you get your head wrapped around that, it's not an issue. And I've been racing the RSR this year in both IMSA and ELMS in preparation for the 24 hours of Le Mans. So same car, same chassis, same steering wheel. So not too much of a learning curve.
So you're in France during this pandemic. What's that been like? Because I've been to Le Mans a couple of times as a spectator, or I mean, as media.
Yeah.
And such a big part of that place is the crowd and the atmosphere and the parade that sure. should be going on, like starting in the next few minutes, right?
Right, right.
So what's it like being there without the crowd? Like, how does it feel different?
Normally there's 300,000 fans here. So going from the motorhome in the paddock to pit lane can be an issue sometimes, with getting stopped all the time by people wanting to take pictures or sign an autograph or something like that. So it's a bit different. And honestly, for me as a driver, it's a shame not to have that many fans here, because, you know, that's what makes this one of the big reasons that makes this race so special is all the true diehard motorsports fans, all 300,000 of them around the 8.5 mile long racetrack. So to be lacking that energy and atmosphere is a shame. But at the same time, like I said, going from the motorhome or whatever to in the paddock to the pit lane is no longer a 20-minute ordeal. It just takes 20 seconds. So that aspect is nice for me.
Silver lining.
But obviously if I had to choose between, you know, having fans here or not, I would obviously want them here, which I think around 50,000 are here this weekend, which is nice. But one of the biggest differences last year was in the race. You know, when you're driving around, when all the fans are on the racetrack, you have camera flashes everywhere, which can be pretty interesting at night. But then last year when we did the race here in September, I believe it was, there weren't too many flashes around. So it was a bit eerie. You know, there wasn't too many people around, which is a bit strange. It was almost kind of like a test day. You know, this year there's 50,000 people here. So hoping for a little bit more excitement, a little bit more energy around the racetrack.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, another thing about your career is you've kind of gone in between GTE AM and GTE Pro. This year you'll be racing GTE Pro with the Porsche. Do you have a preference of one class over the other? And what's the difference between those two classes from the driver perspective?
Well, the cars are virtually the same between the two classes. The RSR and the AM class and the RSR and the Pro class are quite similar, nearly identical, except for a little bit of power, I believe. But the main difference for me is in the AM class, you have to have a bronze driver in the car. And in the Pro category, you don't. So for me, racing in the Pro category I prefer racing in the Pro category because they're, you know, having a bronze driver in the car has its positives and negatives. And finding a really good bronze driver is quite difficult these days. So that provides its own issues. But in the Pro class, you're running with two top, as far as my teammates go, two top professional drivers. So factory Porsche drivers. So, you know, I expect them to drive and perform like professionals. When in the AM category and the bronze in the car, you kind of have to not babysit them, but, you know, make sure that that they don't, you know, make a mistake or something like that. And it's difficult to find a driver that not only has a budget to bring money to the table, has Le Mans experience, and is quick. So those finding those three things in a driver, a bronze driver, is quite difficult. So that was another reason behind running the Pro category.
Yeah. Have you enjoyed running the GTLM category? Because in the United States, that car is separated a little bit. Power, I believe, tire, and correct. Maybe even a little aero. Have you enjoyed because you did 24 hours of Daytona, I believe, yeah? In the RSR, is that right?
We obviously won Sebring, which was really good, and then most recently won at Road America in GTLM. So I definitely have been enjoying the GTLM category. Obviously, I wish there was a bit more competition in the class, but
yeah,
that's, you know, to no fault of my own. But beating the factory Corvettes, factory GM is, you know, enough of a reason for me to run GTLM than anything. So to do that at Sebring, and then my home track at Road America was quite special. And honestly, it's a shame that GTLM is over in IMSA at the end of this year, because the cars and the efforts are so amazing. The teams are so strong that it's a shame that it's going away, but that's the evolution of the sport. Going back to GT3 for the entire GT category in IMSA. So we're trying to get a few more strong performances out of the RSR in GTLM this year in IMSA WeatherTech Championship, and you know, to get two wins already this season not only beating the Corvettes at Sebring, but the BMWs as well was special. So hoping for more.
For this race, you're paired with, I hope I pronounced this correctly, Lawrence Vantor.
Yep, correct.
And Earl Bamber. Yep. How are you guys, like, do you have a game plan? Who's going to get in the car when? And how are you preparing for your stints in the car?
Well, we have driver change practice here in 11 minutes and our pre-race strategy meeting in an hour and 11 minutes. So I believe Lawrence will start the race, then Earl second, both double stints, and then I'll get in after that. I have a minimum drive time of 6 hours per the rules that I have to do in the race. So I'll drive at minimum 6 hours and let the other two take it from there. So with us going up against these factory drivers and factory teams, factory efforts, where these guys push so hard every corner of every lap, we obviously require a little bit different strategy to combat that. And I think our strategy is going to be running clean, consistent laps, staying out of trouble, keeping the car on the racetrack, out of the garage, out of the gravel traps, and hope for no mechanical issues and no tire issues, and see where we end up. And I think if we do that, we'll be fighting for a podium at the end.
Yeah, absolutely. Which, of course, a Le Mans podium is a pretty special thing. And
no doubt.
What's it like, if you could explain a little bit about having, here's what I think about. It's like lapping Le Sarthe, you know, looks like a cool place, but not, especially if you have Road America experience, you're used to high speed stuff. It's not going to be that huge a change. But then lapping that same track in the middle of the night with very little light, with hypercars, you know, going past you, LMP1s in the past, whatever, that starts sounding pretty daunting. So how do you navigate middle of the night, maybe inclement weather, and being one of the slower cars on track? What's that experience like?
It's interesting, that's for sure. It's important to have a strong spotter on the radio calling the faster traffic coming up. And this year we have Jeff Siegel, who's won this race before, as well as he's won Daytona and Sebring before as well. So obviously a guy that is well qualified to not only drive, but see things from a driver's perspective that would help me in the car with him in my ear. So having a strong spotter is extremely important. So having him on board is really nice. It's difficult. You know, the closing speeds, we're doing around 190 miles an hour and they're doing around 210, 220, something like that. So, you know, you have a 30, 40 mile an hour differential between the two classes that could pose some issues. But again, it's a 24-hour long race. Hopefully all the drivers remember that and keep that in their minds, because you can't win the race in the first 8 hours or the first 18 hours. So it's important to get there to the end. But like I said, this will be my eighth time doing it. So a lot of experience here. And yeah, it's a very fast racetrack. If I'm not mistaken, around 80% of the lap is full throttle in our Porsche. So super high speeds, not very physically demanding, but very mentally demanding because of the high speeds. And having a good spotter in your ear takes some of that burden off. But again, still a feat of, something that is not easy. Not everybody can do, but, you know, it is the biggest, most prestigious endurance race there is. So the people that are here, most of them have worked very hard to be here. I expect hopefully some world-class driving and decision making on the racetrack. You know, like I said, you have to get there to the end to fight for a podium or for a win. So hopefully everybody remembers that.
Yeah, and I think you absolutely nailed it. A lot of the tracks, a lot of straightaways and a lot of fourth and fifth gear corners, fast stuff, but the mental focus required to always be paying attention 360 degrees around who's coming behind you, who's ahead of you, and who you're actually racing isn't necessarily who's near you on the track. So the mental focus is, I think, a real test, and that's the real endurance and, you know, absolutely a challenge.
Yeah, and not only that, but I mean, the racetrack is so long, 8.5 miles, it could be raining on half the racetrack and not the other. and the information in the pits is good, but it's not always that good. So you can find yourself in a situation where you come across oil on the track or coolant or rain or something like that, and you weren't expecting it, you didn't know about it before you got there, and all of a sudden you're sideways at 180 miles an hour. So staying out of trouble, running our own race, focusing on our own pace, not trying to wring the neck of the car is really going to be important for longevity.
Well, Cooper McNeil, thank you so much for taking some time to chat with us, and good luck tomorrow in the GT Pro class in your 911 RSR, and good luck in about 5 minutes with driver changes.
Awesome. Thanks, Robin. Thanks for having me.
So there you go. Great conversation from Cooper. Ironic a little bit, you know, he was talking about just needing to complete the race and get through it and be heads up about things. And he was behind the wheel when the car had an accident. So they didn't make it the full 24 hours. They had an accident in the middle of the night that took them out.
It's got to be frustrating, but perhaps less frustrating than friends breaking down halfway around the last lap.
Right.
If you're going to go home, probably sometime around half distance is about as late as you want to leave it. Anything later than that, you start to get your hopes up.
You know? That's right. Yeah. And, you know, it does give you a chance to get some sleep and have a proper breakfast the next morning, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I spoke with Cooper McNeil before the race, but I have a quote from him after the race. And he said, pretty much a solo racing incident. I was pushing and got into the Ford chicane a little too hot and ended up in the wall with a very hard hit. The good news is we had a great race car all race. The WeatherTech Racing Porsche RSR was running strong and things were going according to plan. I am gutted for the team after all of their hard work. I want to thank Lawrence, that's his teammate, Lawrence and Earl. So that's Lawrence, oh boy, I'm going to mess up his name if I don't.
Van Thor
and Earl Bamber. I am disappointed we didn't make it to the checker. So, you know.
I'm sure he is.
You know.
It's all right. You know, who hasn't made that mistake in Gran Turismo? Sometimes you're going too fast, gets tricky, you lose it. There's a wall there.
That's a good question. Why didn't they just hit the reset button? That's what I would have done.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it wasn't just Le Mans racing this weekend because of the weird schedule. I mean, I think that's something we haven't talked about yet. Because of Le Mans not being in the middle of June, that threw everything in kind of a tizzy. And IMSA worked really hard to rework its schedule so that it didn't compete with Le Mans. But right. IndyCar had a race Saturday night at Gateway International Speedway in southern Illinois, just outside of St. Louis. And that turned into quite the race with just all kinds of important things happening in terms of championship contention. Just a lot of people falling out in weird ways and lots of things shifting around.
Mm-hmm. It was as action-packed in 2 hours as Le Mans hadn't been up to that point. Scott Dixon has come out and said that the driving standards this year are crazy and erratic. Do you agree with that? Do you think we saw moves that were... I mean, I guess he's referring, obviously, he got... You know, Dixon was he leading the championship? He was third.
He was third.
He was third.
He was
Alex
third,
Palou
but he was
leading his teammate.
Yes.
And then they both got taken out. Well, Alex Palou took out. No, it was VK took them both out. That's
well,
right.
And VK is technically.
Second?
Technically, I think what happened, VK hit Palou, and Palou
yeah.
then hit Dixon.
Turned into. Yeah, and it wasn't even a big hit. It was just they were side by side, and they were kind of, they got together, and I think VK's rear wheel got up a little bit on the floor of, because you know there's that bit of the floor that sticks out underneath like the radiator side pod.
That's right.
I think his tire just got up a little bit on that, and that's in, you know, when you're going side by side on an oval race, on an oval, that's enough to just pitch the car a bit. And yeah, three of them got no points.
I think that Dixon has a point, frankly, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. And you do have to, looking at that move to me, so this Gateway is a short oval. It's an oval race, but there is definitely you're braking going down a couple gears into the corners. And VK just broke way too late and understeered into Palou. To me, it seemed pretty straightforward. And when your apex speed is whatever, 140 miles an hour, give or take, these are high consequence corners is my point. And you have to be careful not to be braking too late too often. And so I think that's where you have to forgive Dixon if he's maybe he's venting a little bit, but I think he has a really good point. And also, we had, gosh, you know, the first 80 laps of the race, 40 laps of that were caution.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, because, you know...
We talked about this last time, about how many laps Oriel Servia led at Nashville or wherever.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And it's a little bit more understandable here, and they did eventually get into a rhythm, and we had a lot of green flag running for the second half, but...
Yeah, but yeah. Is that just because a whole bunch of people, the talent level, we got to the point where, you know, the people ran out of talent and then everyone who was left could race cleanly. I suppose that's not really the case, but sometimes it feels like that.
24 cars started, 15 finished.
Mm-hmm.
There's an argument to be made there, but there were some really interesting things to talk about other than crashes. That was Romain Grosjean's first oval race. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting. There were a couple of really telling moments that he was new to ovals after a green flag pit stop, and he got up to speed and had a really – he almost got into the wall because he was learning about how tires warmed up on an oval versus a road course and the consequences there. The other thing, James Hinchcliffe was just way off the pace compared to everybody else. I'm not exactly sure why. But generally speaking, it was a lot of really good, close racing – once we got to that, you know, once we got those early incidents out of the way and people cleaned up their act.
You've just reminded me of something which is kind of not really related to IndyCar, but can I bring it up? It's your favorite topic. It's about F1. Did you hear the rumor that Andretti wants to start an F1 team or wants
an
F1 team?
Yes,
I did. Apparently,
hear that rumor.
That is why apparently they wanted to raise $250 million with a SPAC. So they're not going to make an electric car. They want an F1 team.
that's a funny story.
It could happen, you know. It could happen.
So there were a couple of the people that came out wasn't due to accidents, but Colton Herta and Felix Rosenquist both had drive shaft or I think half shaft issues, and that was fascinating to me that there were half shaft failures going on. Do you have any insight as to why you think there'd be half shaft failure?
You must be confusing me for an engineer. So
because
they were race cars and they drove them really hard and they drove them harder than those.
That is excellent insight, sir. Thank you for that. I did not think of that.
That's my official.
Yeah, you know, it was a great race. And it went on to be just a fantastic result for Penske.
It was a great result for Penske.
And it's been kind of a weird enough year that I can say that I'm happy for Penske that they finally were able to break through a bit like this, even though this was, you know, these Penske are typically not the people you feel sorry for, but it was a Penske 1-3-4 result, Joseph Newgarden winning. And then it was the Arrow McLaren SP of Pato O'Ward, who is now the leader in the championship, taking second, but Will Power was third and Scott McLaughlin was fourth. And you don't have to go that far down. Simon Pagenaud finished eighth. And that is despite having an incident with Joseph Newgarden early in the race. Poor Pagenaud has had a rough August. It was a Penske 1-3-4-8 in this race. That's more typical of where you expect to see Penske. Also, a shout out to Sebastian Bourdais for a top five. Takuma Sato was sixth. And then Ryan Hunter-Reay was in seventh. Romain Grosjean ended up finishing 14th a lap down. But he was only a lap down because of... he pitted under green right before a caution. So he was a lap down and he would have gotten his lap back when all the pits cycled through, but he was unlucky because everyone else could pit under yellow and stay on the lap. So that's how he lost the lap. Any other standout performances that we should mention?
Well, Pato did some good overtakes, I thought. Was a good result for Taku. I hope we see him in a car next year. I'd be sad if we don't, but my wife keeps shouting at the TV, but go to sports cars, go to sports cars. Who knows, maybe we could see a Jensen Button Takuma Sato super team in LMDH. Oh, that'd be amazing, wouldn't it?
I would not be too upset to see Sato in IMSA racing, you know, especially if he ended up in a DPI car.
Mm-hmm. I talked to John Ikeda about that, who's the head of like R&D for Acura Motorsport. At the time, he said he didn't think Taku had any interest in sports car racing, which I find really sad.
Huh.
But who knows? Maybe he'll decide he wants to do it. But he's going to be 45 next year. So
yeah, that's young.
Quite a long career. And at some point, I suppose maybe you want to stop driving race cars.
Jimmy Johnson is going to be 46 in a month. Same for Elio Castroneves next year. That's not, and you know, that's fine. He's got plenty of time.
True. There's time for both of us yet.
And so, speaking of arguments and disagreements, John, like we've had, guess who disagrees with both of us?
Mario Andretti.
Wrong, but probably. It was Rob Holland. Rob Holland, because I asked him about what he thought of the Nashville race, because he competed in the SRO events that were part of the Nashville weekend. So let's hear from Rob now.
All right. You're officially on.
Hey, I'm on.
Woo! Rob Holland, it is so good to have you back on the podcast, especially coming off of two race podiums, I believe I'm correct, at Nashville. How'd that race go for you?
Yeah, dude. Well, thanks for having me back. Yeah, it went really well. You go into the weekend and you really never know. I mean, this is it's a new course. So, I mean, that's the thing, is that you really just have no idea how things are going to play out. Like, it's the one thing in racing that you know, if you've been doing this long enough, you know the circuits, you know how they race, you know how you race the circuits, you know how your car is going to do on the circuit. So you kind of like have an idea where you're going to be kind of going into the race weekend. But then when you get like a brand new circuit that no one's ever driven before, there's no video, there's no data, there's no setup, there's no nothing. It's kind of cool. You kind of go into it blind. So we went into it, I'm always good at street circuits. I like new courses. I learned them very quickly. We went in thinking, we were going to do fairly well, and we ended up coming away with a second place and a third place. So would have liked to have taken top step, but that wasn't to be.
Yeah, I mean, those last steps, that why
it's not worth relevant when you're looking for every point you can get in a championship battle. Well, yes,
but that's what I was going to ask about. How was it for your championship? So how did your championship rivals do compared to you?
We did better than them in both races. So we came into the race weekend in third place. We're now in second place, and we've closed the gap slightly. Unfortunately, the guy who's leading the championship finished right behind me in both days. So so I picked up a few points on him. It won't be enough. We're going to have to take a lot more points off of him. But you can't sit there and in a championship, you'll take every point you can get. We still have six races to go, three events. So from our perspective, that if we can keep the pressure on, hopefully he either makes a mistake or we can end up with a really solid result and him a bit farther back down on the points list. So we'll see. But yeah, I mean, it was an awesome weekend. I mean, Nashville, like that's a town that just cries out for a street race. It's just like Vegas and Austin, Texas, if they like got together, hooked up and like had an illegitimate child, that would be Nashville. So
well, with the Vegas part, it would have to be illegitimate.
Of course. Yeah. What happens in Vegas? Yeah. But it was awesome. Like, I'd been to Nashville before just to party and have a good time, but it was so cool in the context of having the race there that the town like really came out to support it. I think they've been starving for racing for a while. We got so many people that came up to us. Random people would be like, guys, we follow NASCAR. We really, wish the NASCAR races are back here. But like, we came to this race just kind of because it was racing and we just figured we'd see it. And like, we're now sports car fans. Like, we literally converted 150,000 people into sports car fans, which was awesome. So
yeah, that's super cool. And absolutely appropriate as well, because sports car racing provides so much value for the racing dollar. Great entertainment, relatively high safety, and performance levels of these cars these days are fantastic. Despite the one criticism of sports car racing these days is that the horsepower numbers are actually pretty low, considering what street cars are capable of these days in terms of straight line performance.
But I think that's irrelevant to the overall speed. I mean, people,
listen, I'm sorry to interrupt. I know that, and I know you know that, but just we're talking about
the average consumer is like, ooh, why is your car only 550 horsepower and where mine is 700? I'm like, well, my 650 or 550 horsepower car will run circles around your 900 horsepower car. It's irrelevant. So, but I get it from a marketing standpoint, but I think the people who were there were so, super excited. The cars sound great. They look great. We had a couple of big wrecks, which unfortunately kind of affected the racing a bit, because we just didn't have as much green flag racing as we would have liked. And in fact, both races ended under full course yellow, which was a bit unfortunate. You kind of want to at least, you know, do a green, white checker, you know, dash to the finish line type of thing. And the nature of the course, the nature of the crashes, and the fact that, you know, Nashville, this is the first time they've done it. So I think that they weren't as efficient as they could have been. I mean, no knock on the guys who were doing it. It's just, you know, the guys who do Long Beach have been doing this for years, or Macau. You know, Macau has cranes everywhere. Like, you crash a car at Macau, they can literally scoop it and pick the car up and drop it someplace else before the race comes back around. They never even go yellow. So it was a bit different for Nashville, but at the same point in time, like, it's amazing when you look at this, that what was required to put on a new event, and these guys, you know, were all new to the race promotion side of things. And, you know, all the little details and all the little things that could have gone wrong. And there's stuff that they can probably fix and do better for next year. But they did an amazing job in pulling that race off. And, you know, and the crowd is, so we had practice Friday. And our second practice was like 6 to 7 in the evening or something like that. And there were full stands throughout our full practice at 6 o'clock in the evening. It was probably the most packed I've seen of stands for practice. And then our race day was even more packed, and that was from 7 to 8 in the evening. It was right after the concert let out, and they just filled the stands with everybody who was leaving the concert, and we had a full house at 8 o'clock in the evening. So that was pretty cool.
That's very, very cool. But I'm so glad you said what you said and exactly how you said it, because I have some criticisms of that track myself, and I'm really curious to hear your opinion on it, because from my point of view, there was a lot to be desired. The whole just wide straight going into narrow and tight corners, and just the number of corners and how they were situated, it led to a 9 caution IndyCar race. And then that whole, there's novelty in racing over a big bridge and going over in both directions. But long-term, truly, is that the right thing to do in terms of safety and access and everything else? From your point of view, from a driver's point of view, what was it like?
You know, that's like a loaded question, and it's a good question. The first thing is that it was a very, very technical track. You could say that it leads to cautions, but it's not the track's fault. It's the driver's fault. Like, the track didn't do anything wrong. The track is just there, and we as drivers have to negotiate it. And, you know, there were a couple of drivers that kind of made the same comments that you did about how the track was really narrow and this and that. And, you know, okay, it wasn't that great for passing and this, that, and the other. And I'm like, well, but Macau is one of the greatest street courses in history, if not the single greatest street course in history. And it's narrow AF. I mean, that is the narrowest track I've ever raced. And when a car crashes at Macau, it takes out half of the field because it blocks the track. So you could literally look at that and level the same criticism at Macau, but yet we still call it one of the greatest road courses or street courses in the entire world. So I don't think necessarily that the narrowness of the circuit really detracted from me from the racing. In fact, the cool thing about the circuit, it was something that when they announced the circuit, we announced that we were racing, I went in and Google Maps and just kind of looked at it to see kind of what it was from the perspective, and then did the whole Google drive through thing so I could see elevations and corners and stuff. And the thing that stood out to me most was the coming off of both bridges, going in both directions, is that it is a very, very, very fast sweeping right-hand corner in both directions, leading into a very, very heavy brake zone. And my thought was, man, the car is really going to be loaded up here. I'm not sure if that's going to be flat or how you're going to approach it. And you're also transitioning off the bridge onto the pavement. So there's a bump there, right? Whoa. Where you don't want it.
Bump there and a pavement change too, maybe.
And a pavement change. I mean, so there's a whole bunch of things going on, which I kind of like as a driver. I mean, because it's not just this like, okay, drive, brake. It's not Coda. I mean, I like Coda, but it Coda is very kind of just turn left, turn right, everything's smooth, and, you know, take the curbing, do whatever you want. Whereas this was like, no, you really got to work at this. And so that corner, like, I still, especially the corner going back into downtown, I still think that there's, you know, for me, a bit of time there, actually a fair bit of time, because you're just, you try to approach it somewhat cautiously, because you're, you know, you're, we're at 100 and oh, I think it was 140 something miles an hour, coming over that bridge into a brake zone that you need to slow the car down to 40 miles an hour. And it goes from super wide to super narrow. So there's a lot of things going on that you're just like, yeah, I'm going to work my way up to this. So no, man. Like, and from a safety standpoint, I didn't really have a problem with it. I don't think the bridge, you know, I don't think anyone's going to wreck on the bridge unless they have a car issue or something like that. Sure, there could be a point in time that is an issue, but I thought it was cool. I mean, and it's a great spectacular backdrop, which is what you want for the racing. It's tough. Like, I'm sure you can criticize it and say, hey, in the future, this could be an issue, whatever. I agree. But also I enjoyed it. Like, I enjoyed actually the section around the stadium was more of a classic street circuit with, you know, 90 degree right-hand corners, but even that had like a little more elevation change than I was expecting. So there were some corners you can attack differently. So I enjoyed it. I had a fun time. You know, so there were a couple small criticisms. One of the big things is that where they start on the bridge coming back in towards the stadium. Mm-hmm. And it's the way that the road curves and the temporary nature of the flagger stand, and also the fact that the flagger stand is behind the fencing. If you're not on that front couple of rows, you can't see the flagger. Like, you have no idea where the flag is coming out of the fence, because the guy has to, you know, sit there and wave it. So you see nothing, and you're like scanning the fence. And then like way down there, there's a guy with a flag, and you're like, oh, he's been waving that for like 5 seconds now, and everybody's already gone. So so small things like that. Those are just little things. I mean, they could just use a light board, and I think that would probably be a bit better for everybody.
Two things. First, mm-hmm. I'm going to cancel my appointment to have you be my driving coach at COTA. and you just explained everything there. And then secondly, if you were completely in charge of everything at Nashville, would you, other than maybe the start finish, would you change anything about the track layout?
You know, I'd like to try to experiment. I mean, the one thing you would love to do that just isn't ever going to happen just because of the expense and the logistical issues is I'd like to go up Broadway. I'd like to go over that bridge, and then instead of hanging a left going through the small section, is hang a right and go right up, you know, right and then a left, and then go right up Broadway, which is where all the bars and restaurants and everything are, which I just think would be absolutely spectacular. But you'd have to shut down a half a dozen bars and restaurants, you know, and they would lose that revenue for 4 or 5 days of which it's going to probably be one of their biggest revenue generating weekends ever. And so you're going to spend $5 million just paying everybody off, which just, it would never happen. Yes, that narrow section, it would be nice. It would be nice to have a couple of more legitimate passing zones, you know, that narrow section kind of takes away. There's really not much room to pass. And especially with GT America being, you know, a multi-class series with GT3 and GT4, had that race gone green. And in qualifying, we had some issues just with just the fact that there's no place for the GT3 cars to get around the GT4 cars. And we're on a qualifying lap, and we're like, guys, sorry, we can't let you by. So, you know, it's things got a little jumbled in there. Other than that, like, I really have a hard time. The cool thing about the narrow section, which I didn't even realize until we had all the spectators there, is that they, because of the narrowness and the slowness of that section, they're able to build the spectator stands right up to the, damn near the edge of the barriers. Mm. And so literally, like, you come in and it's almost like this Roman Colosseum where you've got spectators looking down from all sides. Like, you're looking up and like spectators are right there, and you're just like, that's pretty cool. So
you get any thumbs up or thumbs down?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Like, you're like, oh, screw that one up. But no, so that was kind of cool. And also, you know, because of the narrowness of that circuit and the K rails that are placed everywhere, but like the echo coming off of the cars, like even with being a driver in the car, you heard the echo, you heard the cars go through, and you're like, ah, that's some cool stuff. So, you know, I think it's one of those, it will find its way to mature, and maybe there's a bigger section that they can include in the downtown side of things or whatever. But overall, logistically, you know, and just what they created, that's the one thing that I appreciate. And then some of the other promoters haven't quite embraced yet is that was, it was a full weekend. It was like a, it was a, it was a happening. It wasn't just like a car race. It was a car race. It was a music festival. It was like all of these various things going on. So from people who were the spectators there, there was always something going. If you didn't want to watch the racing that was going on, you could go see a concert. You could go do all these other different little things, which I liked. And they started to, and I think they could probably do more, but they utilized the stadium, which I think is one of the cooler things, is because now you've got this 80,000 person venue that can be used during the course of that weekend. So you can do other events that don't detract from the main event, which is the racing, but it still gives the spectator a break. I mean, because I've gone to races and, you know, there are times where you're just like, all right, it's been fun watching 4 hours of racing. I'd like to do something else for an hour or two before I come back and watch more racing. And that's what this, you know, the football stadium allowed was their ability to go do that and kind of give yourself a break from that. So it was cool. I enjoyed it. I really did. I honestly enjoyed it.
Well, and I think what you're getting at, which is the single hardest thing and the single best thing about the event, is that the entire city embraced it. Yeah. And it wasn't like some parking lot of some section of some town, cough, Miami, former Miami. Miami, cough.
But here's the thing, though, is I think Miami is going to end up being the same thing. Because when they first announced it, I'm like, oh, great. You know, it's going through a parking lot in front of a football stadium. Like, that's like the most lamest street course ever.
Yeah. And are they going to put cones up? Is it going to be a Formula One Gymkhana?
Yeah, right. Exactly. So, or we used to do them, like, used to call, like, when I was bike racing, it used to be parking lot crits. You know, you would do a little criterion in a parking lot, and they'd stick up a bunch of cones, and it would be you and your family, and they'd be, yay, and that was it. And it was really boring. Whereas this was like,
no, everyone gets a participation trophy.
Exactly. And that's what, you know, that's what I really was like, oh God, here we go. But
the case, I want to compete in that then I can.
Exactly. So it was cool in that sense that it was, it really, they did a great job in dressing everything up. They had more than enough porta potties. They had more than enough places to eat and drink and you know, be able to actually have an enjoyable day. I saw tons and tons of people with kids, which I always want to see at racing, because that's the next generation of driver and fan and crew person and whatever. So seeing all those people with kids and families and stuff was awesome to see. Yeah, I mean, and I also liked the fact that we were racing into the night. I mean, our headlights are not good enough to be racing super late. That's probably one thing I would change. We were probably 15 minutes, maybe a half an hour too late in the day. Just our visibility was starting to go down pretty drastically. So 15 minutes would have been enough. 30 minutes would have been great to just kind of give yourself some margin for error. But yeah, it was definitely getting a bit dark.
Well, so, yeah. You know what you should do is, we can fix all of this if you just, instead of going to Nashville, you go to Le Mans. that track.
Good has segue. Plenty of space. Well played.
Segue. This coming weekend is the 24 Hours of Le Mans. I know you haven't actually gotten to race in it yourself just yet, but you've raced in Europe a fair amount. I know you know lots about the dynamics of European racing. Is there anything particularly intriguing about the 24 Hours of Le Mans to you, the hypercars, the fact that hybrids are going away? Where's your head at with Le Mans?
Well, I mean, everything right now. I mean, I think they're in this interesting transition period for the next few years, you know, because they've obviously just announced, and I don't know if you've seen it, but that GT3 cars will be replacing the GTE cars in both WEC and also in Le Mans.
And that's logical, right? I mean,
I don't know why. I mean, it's the double-edged sword of being involved with manufacturers. Obviously, everybody wants manufacturer support. Everybody wants, I mean, without manufacturers, we wouldn't have any racing and it wouldn't be really relevant. So there wouldn't be a point to it. So
yeah, I mean, what would sports car racing be without gentlemen drivers and the manufacturers?
You know, we wouldn't have anything. It'd be a bunch of unpaid pros going around in circles in some pretty crappy cars. So that's the thing, is that you want the manufacturers involved, but then they have their own reasons and you know, understanding of what they want to get out of the sport. And they, manufacturers for years have pushed for the GTE category, which just never made any sense to me, because the GTE category isn't relevant to any other homologated car out there. It's not being raced anywhere else, but within its own category. And it is so limited because it is only manufactured teams. I mean, they at Le Mans, I mean, in WEC, they do have an amateur GTE program, you know, Pro-Am GTE program, but the cars are a different spec. You know, the GTE Pro cars are the current cars, and where the GTE AM cars are the last generation cars. So there's always going to be some lap time and performance delta between the two, which I just never got.
That's not easy to understand.
It's not easy to understand as a fan. I mean, because the fans go, oh, it's the amateurs. Of course they're slower. And I'm like, well, no, it's because they're driving last year's car. And from my perspective, and this is what the manufacturers don't want, from my perspective, I would love to see an AM team go ahead and beat the pros, you know?
How
awesome would that be? Or at least give them a hard time on the podium or whatever it is. But I really don't like the fact that you're basically, because you're not in the latest equipment, you're not a pro, you don't have any opportunity at all to win. So I think that's stupid. That they should do a GT AM class that runs the same car. And if you can climb your way up onto the overall GTE the podium, then good on you. So you know, so I never liked that. So I love the fact that they're bringing in GT3. I'm hoping that there is a mix of that, whether it's just one big, you know, GT3 field, or even if they classify things as pro and pro am, that they're still running the same level of equipment. And more importantly, that they're still running the same level of equipment that everybody else is, because now there's a talk of a GT3 plus, which is would only be for WEC and for Le Mans. And
that just, I hope they don't do that.
No, and it's just like, because then anyone who's running WEC or Le Mans can't run the car anywhere else, because now it's not in the same spec as the GTD class and IMSA. So once again, it's and this is the frustrating thing about motorsports, is like they shoot themselves in the foot on a constant basis. It's like, look, we understand that you want some differentiation, but that's not how this should work. Literally, let's just run a class of cars, and the best guys to run that class of car at all times should be the guys who win it. And, you know, amateur, pro, factory, non-factory, whatever. Let's just hear the cars, go have at it.
Yeah, 100%. I totally agree with that. And I think that's what IMSA is doing, is there's going to be a GT3 Pro. I mean, they'll call it GTD, but GT3 Pro and GTD AM. But it will be the same car, just different. Right. Different, you know, there's the bronze, silver, gold, platinum class. But
I'm very frustrated, as I really think that the whole platinum, bronze, silver thing needs to kind of go away. Not in the sense of completely go away. I think it's just it's a terrible system, because you can't classify drivers into four big giant categories. And I think it's very silly. Like I'm a bronze driver right now. And I'm only a bronze driver because I've aged out of everything else. So,
I mean, and here's the funny thing. Driver, just like Scott Pruitt is a bronze driver.
Andy Pilgrim, Randy Post, all of these guys, you know, are bronze drivers. And you're going, look, these guys have got Le Mans wins. They've got Daytona 24 wins. You don't like all of a sudden, because you turn 50, all of a sudden forget how to race a car. And in fact, I was talking to Jack Baldwin.
Bill Alderlin, I think he's another one that he
might. Yeah, Bill Alderlin. I mean, I was talking to Jack Baldwin. Jack Baldwin is like, he's like his last years of racing when he won I don't remember what the class was at the time, but he won World Challenge, GTS. He won the GTS Championship and World Challenge, which is GT4 right now. He's like, that was some of my best driving ever. He was like, I was so precise and so really just cognizant of everything that was going on. He was like, that was some of my best driving ever. And he was in his 60s at that point. So you look at this and you go, okay, well, wait a second. You know, why are we all of a sudden classified as bronze? But then the other side.
No, Rob, I know why. It's because you guys have to take all those bathroom breaks.
That's what it is. You can't have to calculate that extra
five minutes and everything else. Yeah.
Well, but the thing is that I don't understand. Like, we're a sport that is technology driven, and if you look at all of the technology companies that are involved in motorsport, why is it that we have to use this arbitrary system to rank people? A bronze should be a rookie driver who doesn't have the experience. A silver should be a guy who has a few years of experience, but maybe isn't as fast. And then a gold should be who has the experience and who's quick. And a platinum should be a factory driver. But the way you put those guys in that category shouldn't be just an arbitrary decision. We have all of the data, all of the metrics to go, okay, here's your fast lap at Spa. Here's your fast lap at all these other tracks you run. Here's your fast lap versus your teammate. Here's how your teammate ranked to get everybody else. Here's your fast lap in your car versus all of the other same cars that are run in GT3 or GT4. You know, here's your overall finish. Here's your 10 lap best times, your best average times, your 20 lap best average. You can calculate all of this and put it into a formula that goes here. This is a driver that on a scale from 1 to 100 ranks as a 75. And that 75 puts you on the border of the silver and a gold. You know, gold is 80 to 90, 90 above is platinum. And if you're a paid works driver, you're automatically a platinum. Doesn't make a difference how old you are. And all of those things should be very, very, very easy to calculate. And then what you do is you give the FIA the ability to raise or lower your point score by 5 in either direction. Hey, yeah, you had a crappy year last year, but we know you're still a good driver. So no, you're not a 75, you're an 80, which puts you at a gold. Or, oh yeah, you've had a couple of bad years and I know you're at a 75, but we're going to drop you down a little bit. So you're at the border of a silver and bronze. And then that gives that whole flexibility. And then you go for pro, you can have any number that you wanted. You know, you add 3 drivers together, you average it out and it becomes whatever number. Or pro-am has to be 75 and below on an average.
Yeah.
And then you put a works driver in the car that's 100, and then you got to put 2, you know, 60 bronzes to get your average that makes it a pro-am category. And that's it, done. I mean, and there's no more arguing, there's no more BSing, there's no more sandbagging by everybody. It's just a nightmare right now. And that's one of the frustrating things about Le Mans and WEC is all of that politicking. And you look at the guys who are categorized as bronze and you're like, that guy's
so much politicking. Yeah. Yeah.
So, no, but
the flip side to that though, Rob, and I agree with everything you just said, that's all incredibly logical, is that the tiering system for drivers is kind of like the tax code, United States tax code, right? Every single little iteration is put in most of the time with, you know, good intentions or good enough intentions, but they keep getting added on and added on, and someone calls foul about some rule, so some other thing is tacked on to satisfy them. And before mm-hmm. you know it, you have this ridiculous, convoluted structure, you know, yeah. and we're faced with this reality. It seems to me that it could be as simple as you're either paid or paying to go race, and that should kind of be the beginning and end of it.
There's your bro, there's your yeah. 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 I mean, it could literally be that simple. Now, I mean, I understand what they're trying to do in terms of balancing out the driver lineups, because at the end of the day, like we said, you know, the two most important things in motorsport are manufacturers and gentlemen drivers. So you want to give the gentlemen drivers an easy shot to come in, not an easy shot, but a shot to come in and pair with a pro driver and be competitive, because that's why they're here. They're not here to make up the numbers. They're here to try to be competitive. And if they can do that by being better themselves and having good talent around them, that's what keeps guys like me in cars. So it's hard to say, because that then changes the whole entire model of motorsports. And not saying that you can't go back to where it was, you know, 40, 50 years ago, where it was, you know, manufacturers or nothing. You know, I think here it's good to have that mix. And I think that's where the sport has developed. And it keeps a lot of pro drivers that wouldn't normally be still competitive. It keeps us in cars. So I'm selfish that way.
Well, let's do this. This is the brilliant plan. I love it already. Let's you and I, you start a race team, like take your SRO team to Le Mans next year. Okay. Perfect. And then in the meantime, I'm going to work on a new classification. I'll be the tin class. So that'll be for rookie drivers that also aren't very good. And right. So I'll be your tin class guy. I'll lower your average way down so we can get Scott Pruitt, Randy Pope.
We can get the top guys.
Right.
Get in the car.
Yeah. And then, but you know, I still have to drive at least 6 hours. So that's
Do they make like a negative driver rating? Can you have like a -20 so that it balances everybody else out? Is that a thing?
Yeah. I think I'll get that for you. I mean, do you want to?
Oh, dude, stop it. I've seen you drive. I've seen you drive. Stop being self-evasing and all that BS.
Oh, you sound like my mother, Rob. It's like, oh, come on. You're great. But I appreciate you.
I didn't say you were great. I just said you weren't that bad. Let's be honest here.
You say punk
is slow your roll, man.
Well, is it? But Lamont, I mean, in all seriousness, there's tons of politics and all that kind of stuff. That's all 100% accurate. But every driver, Formula One, IndyCar, sports car, I mean, that's still something you want to do, right, Rob?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's it is definitely a bucket list thing for me. I mean, I came close about half a dozen years ago with a potential seat, and we just couldn't put the deal together. It's one of those that you know, this is the pinnacle of sports car racing. You know, it's that and the 24 hours of Daytona and Sebring, and you know, to be able to compete in those and tick those boxes. I don't know that it's important to me. I mean, I've done enough in my career that I'm very, very happy with what I've done and what I've accomplished. So if I don't ever do them, I think I can live with that. But it is something that I every year I, you know, kind of sit at home and watch Le Mans, and you're kind of like, man, I really want to be there. And knowing that, you know, that a lot of the guys who are racing there currently, you know, you're like, I should be there with those guys.
Right, right, right.
You know, but also too, I've had the opportunity at the 24 Hours of Nürburgring, which I still classify as the best race in the world. I mean, I know it's not.
Well, in terms of racetracks, I mean, God.
In terms of racetracks, but you look who shows up to the 24 Hours of Nürburgring, and it's all the same guys that are at Le Mans, and on a much more difficult circuit. Not that Le Mans is not difficult. I mean, anytime you're, you know, 200 miles an hour trying to break down to a 40 mile an hour chicane in the middle of the darkness in France, is, you know, that's a huge amount. But I also think that driving at 150 miles an hour through some twisty ass mountain road in the middle of Germany at 3 o'clock in the morning when it's snowing out, I think that's probably, you know, it requires a as equal level of skill, if not more so. And you look at the drivers that show up and the teams that show up, and they're all the same guys at Le Mans. So and then the spectators are the same. Like, there's 350,000 spectators at the 24-hour race in Nürburgring, and you know, so I think it's just as much a spectacle. So I've done that. So I'm happy that I've you know, been there and ticked that box. But Le Mans still is definitely one that calls, and it's just such a brilliant race. You know, I've been there as a spectator before, and it's beautiful. I mean, it's just kind of this epic thing, and there's a feel when you're there that as a spectator, and I'm sure even more so as a competitor, of you know, how special that race really, really is.
Yeah. And one thing that Le Mans has over Nürburgring are the crepes are way better.
Yeah, but the Germans do currywurst very well. So
counter argument. I like
oh,
it.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. So it's really funny. I mean, it's such a festive atmosphere. I mean, at both races.
Both races, yeah.
Yeah, but I think the thing about the Nürburgring that is a bit more special is that the spectators are a lot closer to all of the action all over the place. Like, there's a trail that goes around the entire track, and there's not, I mean, it's, you know, 15 and a half miles, and there's like very few sections that you go through that you don't see spectators. So
does the 24-hour race use the Grand Prix course and the Nordschleife combined? Is it the combined?
Yeah. So you start off because of the number of cars, you need to use the Grand Prix pits. So the
Formula okay.
So there's 35 or 38 or something like that, you know, pit boxes that you then share with five other cars. So there's six cars per garage. So it's insane that way. But yeah, so they use the Grand Prix circuit, and then they go on and do the Nordschleife. So it's a much longer lap. It's just with the elevation and the weather and the spectators and what the Nürburgring really is, I think that it becomes this epic race. But I mean, once again, it's not to take anything away from Le Mans. I mean, Le Mans still is that pinnacle of motorsports, and I think you have to appreciate it for that. And I mean, I love the race, and I would really like to compete there at some point in time. So
yeah,
I'm always working the deals to see what can be done to make that happen.
Right. No. And it would be an amazing experience. That place is special. And I think, in all seriousness, the thing that Le Mans has over the 24 hours of Nürburgring is just the class of cars that go. The top class in Nürburgring is GT3 level, correct?
Yes, and, it is a GT3. So no prototypes or anything like that.
So right. And
that's,
so
that's the big thing.
And when you're racing in at night in inclement weather down the Mulsanne straightaway, and all of a sudden you have a hypercar that's going 40 miles an hour faster than you down the straight, and yeah. you have to navigate. Those are the type of moments, right? No one has yet to make. Who would be the Steve McQueen of the era to make a 24 hours of Nürburgring yeah. movie? That would probably yeah. help as well.
I'll play that role. I'll be Steve McQueen. I've been called him before, you know, so by mistake. Uh-huh.
Well, Rob, always great to talk to you. You always have fantastic insights to bring to racing of any sort, be it sports cars, IndyCar, or Le Mans. And I always appreciate your time. And thank you so much.
Robin, thanks for having me. I always enjoy hanging out with you, and I'm always always available to bend your ear for a bit.
So yeah, Rob blames the drivers, not the track, for all those incidents. What do you think about that?
Okay, he raced that track, I didn't. So who am I to argue with that? And I think, you know, we just talked about the fact that driving standards in IndyCar are not great. Maybe we'd have fewer accident still if they had raced on a 80-foot wide track like they did the whole Washington DC IMSA track. Got another plug for that one. Go on. If I mention it enough times, maybe it'll happen again.
That's right. That's right. That's the, just keep saying it until it becomes true.
Field of dreams.
So, well, yeah, but it was a great conversation with Rob, hearing him talk about not only the Nashville track and drivers and all that, but also his take on Le Mans. It's always good to hear from him and hear his insights. It was a really just a great month of racing in August. Of course, we've got one more itty-bitty race coming up in August that I don't know if you'll catch on TiVo later or not, but it's this little thing called Formula One that's happening in Belgium next week. Mm-hmm. But let's just give me the summary. What's the Jonathan Gitlin summary of the racing we had in August?
Well, it kept me occupied. I'm not going to lie. It's not been like the greatest. It's not been the greatest month of racing ever. It was fine. You know, Le Mans was, I've been a bit disinterested in it. We're in this sort of, you know, gap between what was really great, which was the old LMP1 hybrid days. And then for the last few years, it's been like, okay, but you know, it could have been better. And there's this shiny 2023.
Right.
A couple of years away.
We are in a transition, no doubt.
We are. But it was fine. I watched it. IndyCar continues to be really good. I've missed F1 over the break, I'll be honest.
There
I'm
it is.
I'm excited to see.
The English in Jonathan comes out and he finally admits to enjoying Formula One. You know,
I do like Formula One. I've said I like Formula One. I think the cars should be smaller and lighter. And
well, they're getting heavier. 2022, I believe.
I know
they're up to 790 kilograms. You know, we're getting pretty heavy.
Mm-hmm. That's, you know, almost LMP1 weight.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And I think the bigger problem is that they're really wide.
You think that's an issue? I don't think that.
I think the width of the cars is a problem. I think they don't. You know, for a lot of the tracks that they're still racing at. I think that is an issue. I mean, you know, Monaco or Hungary. I mean, these cars are like big trucks. You know, I remember when F1 cars were small little things.
Maybe you should check out MotoGP. Those things are a lot narrower.
Bikes, just they're a foreign language to me.
So I have to say, in terms of just pure racing entertainment for my level of fan-ness, I don't know how to describe that, was the Indianapolis road course race. That was real nice combination
of good
racing, high quality racing, not just a figure eight racing crash show, not a demolition derby.
Right.
Good quality, but still intense action. Le Mans, you know, an important race, a significant result for Toyota, but you're right. It certainly does not have the cachet that it held 5 years ago, 10 years ago, certainly.
But it's coming back.
Yeah.
I think there's even more interest now in LMH and LMDH. So Alpine is probably going to announce a program. We're still waiting to see what GM does. Everyone assumes it's going to be Cadillac, but with the potential loss of a pro GT category at Le Mans in the future, maybe they'll decide to do a Corvette LMDH instead, which honestly, I like, if it was, I think that'd be cool, but I don't think they'll do it. I think there's an outside chance that Corvette does an LMDH. But yeah, apparently, so the rumors that I heard most recently are Geely, which maybe it would be Polestar, but probably not, because Polestar is just electric. So maybe, I don't know, maybe it'd be Lincoln Co. or I can't see it being a Volvo.
Yeah, Volvo
be
would
be cool, though.
Polestar, that'd be cool. Polestar Engineering, Volvo. I mean, that's still kind of a thing.
Uh-huh. And then Tata apparently is also considering it. So we might see a Jaguar, which would be neat.
Fascinating. You sure wouldn't be a Land Rover, John?
You know, I've just been driving a Defender this week, and that thought also appeals to me, but I'm not sure it'd be terribly aerodynamic.
Yes. Well, you know, the future of Le Mans looks to be potentially bright, but we do have to wait and see just a little bit. And I'm very interested to see what Spa brings us, because it has been a few weeks off. We're starting to get into that like proper second half of the championship in Formula One, which, unlike IndyCar, that has three more races to go on the West Coast, you know, we're not much more than halfway done with Formula One. But
Speaking
of aerodynamic cars, my latest video came out, and it is on the Acura TLX Type S, John. And that car is not bad, sir. Not bad at all.
I still need to drive it. But yes, I heard good things. It looks nice. Glad you enjoyed it.
Well, John, yeah, you can learn all about it.
I will check out your video.
In lots of detail, I dig into some engineering bits on that car. And I think the thing that you'll appreciate about the car, I very specifically call it the Civic Type R for grown-ups. So you're a grown-up, sir. Are you not?
I am, apparently.
That means take a gander, why don't you?
I will have a look.
All right. Well, that is all for now, and I want to thank you for listening. Please take a moment to review us on iTunes or on whatever platform you get our podcasts. Please leave comments on the episode of your choice by going to funwithcars.com. As always, I can be reached at feedback@funwithcars.com. Tweet us at fun_with_cars. And check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/FWCars. And go to ArsTechnica.com, right?
Yep.
Yeah. John, always great to chat with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Robin Warner. Goodbye.